You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, this one I am doing live, and there is a reason for that. The reason is that I spent 2 weeks in Asia, and I thought that I had more recorded episodes than I actually did, and I came in this morning and found out that I didn't. So that's fine. I get to spend time with you lovely people, and because it's live, the chat is open. Should anyone wish to post a comment, although because I didn't tell anyone that I was doing a live episode, I don't think there is anyone in the chat. I'm looking at the chat now and there's only one message and it says hello fans from me to complete silence. So anyway, if you do happen to watch these the moment they come out, then you can respond to it. Now, the fact that I was in Asia for those 2 weeks gives me a sort of interesting anecdote to sort of start this one off. You see, because the flight that I was on, as it turned out, and I did check this later, was almost exactly over Tehran at the moment that the strikes began. I flew out sort of, you know, obviously several hours earlier on that. And I know that I was over Tehran because we can see it on the in-flight map. And also I could look out the window. And it later transpired when I did the maths that if I wasn't directly over Tehran at the time the missiles were flying, I would have missed it by no more than about 20 to 30 minutes. And I mean, that just gives us a bit of pause for thought, doesn't it? Because how differently we would have viewed the war if in the first few minutes we had lost one of our best and brightest. The impact that that would have on us all, I mean, especially me, I'm just envisaging the plane getting clipped by some sort of incoming hypersonic missile and breaking apart, and I would have been sort of flapping and flailing as it took about 2.5-3 minutes to tumble to the ground to land on the outskirts of Tehran, wondering in that time what I was going to do with the rest of my life, which would not be very long at all. So that's how close we came, ladies and gentlemen. That's how close we came. That's worth thinking about. But no, so my thoughts on the Iran war. Now, because I'm coming to this a couple of weeks late, I'm not going to give you the standard sort of spiel that you've probably heard 50 times already about who's going to, you know, win the war and all that kind of stuff. I'm looking at this from a different perspective. I'm looking at this from the point of view of risk repricing. And I don't just mean insurance rates or anything like that. What's really happening here is you've got this sort of global multi-agent risk reevaluation going on, or based on incomplete information. And that is everything from the decisions that this state of Iran is making, the state of Israel, the US, the shipping agents, the energy markets, the financial markets, the voters in the various countries. Fascinatingly, the set of decisions that the Gulf state has to make, the decisions that, you know, the rest of the BRICS countries, that Europe has to make. So, I mean, there's a considerable number of people that are going to be forced to reevaluate on this. And as well as that, and they've each got their own. They're each seeing different risks, and they've all got different time horizons, and they're all reacting at different speeds to this. So what you've got is a system that was previously in balance, which is now completely out of sync with itself. And I don't think it's going to proceed linearly as we go through this. This is going to be threshold driven, and the early thresholds came early on with the closing of the Straits of Hormuz, and I don't believe at this time we've lost a single tanker. But if that were to happen, you know, if one oil tanker were to go down, or, you know, God forbid, three or five or something, the knock-on effects for the decision-making that the rest of the system has to make is going to be enormous. And I'm kind of reminded, to bring this back to a sort of financial angle, of the George Soros idea of reflexivity. Now, I know Soros is just the embodiment of evil these days and just spends his time trying to destroy the Western world as fast as he possibly can. But when he was in finance, he was actually genuinely quite brilliant. And the reflexivity model is something that I've been trying to think about this through. And that is not just that, you know, reality informs people's perception of events, but your perception changes your behaviour. That then changes reality, that then changes your perception, and so on and so on. It's a recurring loop. So, you know, behavioural changes can come from the way of which the risk of a set of events or the risk of pricing something is considered as you go through it. Then, of course, we've got the whole dynamic of the asymmetric risk that the different actors are facing within all of this. So Iran has the ability to make these fairly low-cost disruptions, low cost in terms of its attack. The attacks of which it is receiving, of course, of significant cost to it. The US can bear the cost of making expensive attacks, but the cost to the system is what I really want to get into. The destabilization. The Gulf states are having to consider the fact that they have got very high cost exposure in all of this. I mean, not least from being able to ship just their oil, which is existential for them, because of course it's not just a one way oil trade. It's a two way oil for food, technology, electronics, tourism, everything that keeps the desalination plants running. It's of significance to them. As we talked about, China and India, how they decide to Russia, how they decide to play this as well, and then Europe as well, who at the moment are being largely passive and choosing not to involve. But they've got such a degraded energy system, which was already running at the point of very close to insufficiency, very much relying on, you know, last-minute, just-in-time deliveries. The start of the Ukraine war was... Europe faced a mini-energy crisis at that point. So it just doesn't have any resilience at this point. It's only been made up through US-based liquid natural gas. And if the Straits of Hormuz stay shut for any length of time, what will happen is the US will simply start limiting energy exports. And I don't see the solution that Europe has other than to go crawling on its hands and knees to Russia, which completely undermines the geopolitical stance that they've adopted over the last, 4 years at this point. So we're in a flux in the system which favours people who can inject risk cheaply, and that's Iran. And perhaps to a lesser extent, Israel as well. They don't bear this whole burden of costs, other than the fact that Israeli support in the Western world is declining significantly. I looked at some numbers the other day, and it split down Israel support in the US by age group. And amongst young people, support for Israel had literally halved. Now, it wasn't that high to begin with. I think it was something like 40%, but that's halved to just below 20%. And even the oldest generations, even though they're much more resilient because they've been raised on this their whole life, even then, it's turned from something like 60% support to under 50%, which is, again, significant for a state which requires strong Western support. We have to consider the optionality as we go through this. So some actors have high optionality. The US, if it is willing to bear the reputational cost, the cost of walking away, have the ability to do that. They can step away, although it would be humiliating. And it would also play into the loss of empire, which they are likely to be faced with. And we talk about that as we go through. Iran has lots of optionality. And they are using that optionality at the moment to endure significant punishment in order to raise the costs of acting against them significantly. The options of people like Europe are constrained, but the optionality facing China and Russia are also fascinating. To what degree do they wish to lend assistance? To what degree do they want to place pressure on the US or Israel, particularly with the upcoming conference that Trump will be doing to China? And it's all starting to get quite reminiscent of the Suez Crisis in 1956. So in the Suez Crisis, the UK and France obviously got into a dispute with the Egyptian government at the time and tried intervention. And what ultimately ended it was not the fact that the UK and France were unable to militarily achieve its objectives, even though it proved difficult. I mean, ultimately what got them is that the rising global superpower, the US, in that post-war period, was unwilling to bear the second-order costs that came as a result of the Suez Crisis. And they placed pressure on the UK and France to basically withdraw, and they did. Are we going to be looking at a similar situation where the new rising global superpower, China, is going to exert influence on the US to say, no, we are not willing to bear these costs, and if you continue to put us in this situation, we will punish you for it one way or another. And again, China has plenty of options there. So, you know, some people are fully committed, while other people, you know, they have some exit paths, but all of them are constrained. Risk is going to show up in a whole number of ways. It's going to show up in pricing. I mean, insurance, obviously. The physical flow of the energy itself. The narrative is going to be a huge effect, especially on domestic populations in Europe and US. And it's probably going to reprice policy costs over the next few decades. So, you know, the hidden constraints that we have here is this is a coordination failure. And, you know, most of the actors that I'm going to be talking about here, what they prefer is stability and they prefer continued trade. But we're starting to realize that in this globalist system, that cannot be offered. And this is a significant blow coming after the COVID era, which demonstrated that actually, no, you cannot rely on a fully globalized system. You cannot rely on a just-in-time delivery model. You cannot run down your domestic energy and, you know, strategic reserves or strategic industries of whatever it is. And this is just going to be a second nail in the coffin for that globalist system. So I think what we've got to start doing is not asking the straightforward questions, which has been, you know, discussed endlessly on you know, a whole bunch of channels that you would have seen, analysis that you would have seen on this stuff. But we got to ask a little bit more fundamentally. What is the set of decisions and risk pricing that everybody involved in this conflict is going to have to calculate? But I mean, let's start with, first of all, what I think each side in this is trying to achieve, because even answering that question has been problematic for everybody. So starting with the US, I think they are trying to degrade Iran's ability to be a regional power, which is increasingly emerging as, because it is not a US client state. It has strategic depth. It has a coherent and motivated population to take action. I mean, yes, I know that's been under question. Yes, I know there's been protests within Iran. But this is sort of served as a galvanizing function for them. So if the US can degrade Iran as a as a regional power, well, by default, it is the regional power, and therefore it can exercise its will more clearly. Iran, I think, has different set of choices ahead of it. I think Iran wants the long-term inviolability of Iran. So Israel has the long-term inviolability of Iran. And for them, the best outcome is probably going to be to instigate so much chaos that it effectively becomes a failed state over the next 30 years. I think something similar to Iraq, where after the invasion of Iraq, they then spent the next 20 years devolving into competing warlords and no strong centralized government. I suspect that is what they are looking for, which is a much broader and expansive goal than perhaps the US has. But of course, if they can get the US to fight their war, then why wouldn't you take that? And it would effectively leave them as a much more dominant regional player than they are. I think for Iran, what they're looking to do is... I think they're trying to raise the cost of being a US ally in the region. I think they have decided that if they continue along the status quo, they will get hit regularly because, for whatever reason, the influence that Israel has on the US and the set of decisions that the US has to make about how does it preserve its regional hegemon, that they feel that it is unacceptable to be continually exposed to a series of, you know, 12-day wars like we saw last year, and that it is better to receive an absolute pounding if it can raise the costs of the war to the global level, which has certainly been achieved at this point. I mean, an additional factor for the US I should probably mention is they are no doubt concerned about the creeping influence of China in this, with Iran being a Chinese ally. I think that one is going to backfire spectacularly. The Gulf states, they've got to consider the least risk patron at this point. Perhaps Saudi Arabia has the potential to be the dominant regional power, but certainly none of the rest of them do. And for whatever reason, Saudi has not really demonstrated the sort of military coherence that might suggest that they're in that place. So I think the Gulf states understand that they are client states. But is the US able to provide the protection? I mean, the US has effectively been running for the last, well, since Bretton Woods, really. Well, since the mid-70s, certainly. The US has been running a protection racket in the Gulf states. They've basically, well, they started off, and then this is the sort of formation of the petrodollars. They went to the House of Saud and said, we will guarantee your security. You've got a lot of nice oil. But you've got a population that would drag you into the streets and do unspeakable things to you if they could. And you've got hostile, warring Arab states around you. And of course, the Arabs do like to fight amongst themselves. So we will provide security for you. And in return, you will sell your oil in dollars and only dollars. And thus the birth of the petrodollar system, which was exactly what the US dollar needed after 1971 and it came off gold. And the value of the petrodollar system, and I mean, I've talked about it before a number of times on Brokenomics, but it can't be overstated. But that does rely on the protection racket working. If the US is not able to upkeep its side of the bargain, which is the security in exchange for you will only sell in dollars, it is rational for the Gulf states to start to consider what other patronage options they have. It doesn't have to be Iran, but it could be some combination of the BRICS as a whole, Russia and China. Russia and China is a powerful combination, because with that you get the military expertise of the Russians, you get the market of the Chinese in India, you get the technical support of the Chinese. At what point does it become viable for these Gulf states to seek their protection from BRICS as opposed to the US? Now, bear in mind, the US has already had a rather humiliating retreat from Afghanistan. and it has launched this war without clear objectives, presumably hoping for a short war, to remind the region who's boss, and it doesn't appear to be working out that way. The BRICS states, China, Russia, perhaps to a lesser extent India and some of the rest of them, of course, it's in their interests if the US ceases to be a global power. They would probably much prefer them to become a regional power, and that process is already underway. You can already see the Trump administration reprioritizing from being a global power to shoring up its own theater of influence, and thus increased actions in South America, thus increasing concern about the way that Western Europe is driving itself off a cliff. Nevertheless, it has its key clients in other parts of the world, the Middle East being a key one of those, and, you know, Taiwan perhaps being another one. But if you can break US global dominance, which this war has the signs of being able to do, then the world will move to a multipolar world. And some people will say we're already in there. I don't think we are necessarily, because China does not yet show any ability to project force. It would probably be a more whole of BRICS effort if they were to come to that. But that would give them considerable further leverage. And then finally, Europe. They cannot maintain their energy situation without the Straits of Hormuz opening. And that is not because the Strait of Hormuz is primarily supplying Europe. Most of what goes through the Straits of Hormuz is going to be going towards Asia. A lot of it goes to China, but it's very important for India and Japan as well. The problem that Europe have got is that because it is a global energy market, by raising the marginal cost of energy, they're already strained to the point where their system is insufficiently holding on anyway. Domestic energy prices have been a huge issue in Britain over the last, since COVID. Certainly since the beginning of the Ukraine war, it has been a constant issue. And what will happen if energy prices go up is it will simply cause the rerouting of energy supplies from lower bidders to higher bidders. And Europe being relatively rich at the moment, although for how much longer its paper money is given that credence, I don't know. But think back to, and this was a few years ago, what ultimately was the issue in Sri Lanka, which, if you recall, led to, you know, a change of government. It led to the president's compound being broken open and his collection of nice cars being pushed into the river. It led to basically a sort of internal revolution. And ultimately, the cause for that is because Sri Lanka ran out of dollars, meaning that it couldn't buy oil. Now, I don't think we're necessarily at the point of dollars running out, because the US can just print more whenever it damn well pleases. But if the oil just literally isn't there to be bought, it's going to get redirected towards the higher bidders. Now, the people who are bidding more for that are going to bear the costs associated with that and the demand destruction that comes through, which then leads to... I mean, demand destruction is basically just being people deciding to use less because it's no longer in their economic sense in order to spend the energy. But then further afield, how many developing nations are going to be effectively priced out, which in turn then means their yield of agricultural goods or commodities or whatever it is that they produce is also going to be constrained, which then feeds back into the Western system as well. So that's the broad overview of what I'm going to be trying to look at.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.